Good morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Good morning, and wake up. If I got to be up, you got to be up. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. How is everybody today? And let's say a special good morning to all our pandering legislators from coast to coast. Say good morning to the truckers. Good morning to the bakers on the West Coast. Good morning to everyone who is listening to us this morning. We got a very special guest host in studio because Marc Maron is back on Monday. I feel really envious of Maron Tooman. He's out in L.A. He's enjoying himself. It's nice and warm. But you know who we got here in studio? Award-winning Newsday columnist, Mr. Ellis Hennigan. Good morning.
Riley, man, you really do know how to wake the folks up.
I'm trying, man.
I thought I was already awake. I didn't realize I had all those cobwebs in my ears.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing very well. It's very nice of you to have me. I hope our buddy's having a good time out in California.
Yeah,
I will do my best. Best today to keep the seat warm.
There you go.
Your beloved co-host.
Now, Ellis and I have history. Ellis and I have worked together on a couple of Fox News Channel programs. We spent some quality time in green rooms across the city of New York together.
That is, you know, I was trying to remember back. I came to New York in 1985 from Louisiana and to be a reporter up here. And you've been here like 20 years already. It's 400 years, Riley.
Oh, my
been around
God. Oh, no. Right. I'm a piece of furniture now.
Well,
I'm an antique.
I was going to say a legend, actually. But,
I'll go with legend.
I'll go. But, yeah, I mean, you at WLIB Radio. I mean, covering stuff and working on the radio and being a kind of this, like, you know, guy with the voice in New York.
Well, I had a big afro and a bad attitude back then. And we used to go around and come. You know the first story
I ever... Wait, by the way, you still have a bad attitude.
What can I tell you? Just much less hair. The first story I ever covered was a protest at the Apollo Theater. This guy was upset with James Brown. Now, you know, back in those days, this is in the early 70s, mm-hmm. when James Brown came to the Apollo, there were, like, lines around the block.
Sure.
Right? I mean, everybody came out to see James Brown. It was like a ritual.
Sure.
I used to go. I mean, I was a James Brown fanatic. So my news director at the time, David Lampel, says, listen, this guy is holding a protest about James. He wasn't doing enough for the community, whoever this guy was that was holding the protest. So I walk across, the station at that time was on Lenox Avenue and 125th Street in New York. That's in the heart of Harlem, for those of you who've never been to New York City. And I walked across 125th Street from Lenox over to between 7th and 8th to the Apollo. And it was like three people in front of the Apollo protesting. And my job was to interview the leader of this protest, James Brown. And, of course, when it was all said and done, when I finished doing the interview, the guy's like going up to the box office looking for tickets.
I thought you were going to tell me it was a 12-year-old Al Sharpton
who then
went on to work for
James
Brown. Yeah, no, I remember I didn't go back quite that far, but I mean, I remember being a young reporter in New York and you being out there and running around. And you're right, over the years we've done Talking Head TV stuff together.
Absolutely.
We've been in Green Room.
I think we've done New York One together.
Probably,
times,
maybe
yeah.
going back to New York. For some reason, I have this memory of being in green rooms with you, with outnumbered by 14 angry blonde conservative women
yeah.
in miniskirts who looked at both of us and saw their ex-husbands.
Yeah.
I think that was the truth.
Yeah, and said, listen, you two get no slack whatsoever. But, there's a kind of green room culture, Ellis, and I know you're aware of it because you've spent enough time in it. You've got guys, and we won't name names for the purposes of this discussion, but you have guys who will go into a green room, pick up the green room telephone, and then proceed to book themselves with producers on shows on the same network, and they play them off against each other. Oh, yeah, well, so-and-so said he wanted me on at 9 o'clock. Can you get me on a little earlier? I mean, guys bring their lunches, bring full-course meals from Chinese restaurants in big brown paper bags. Green room etiquette is an amazing, and part of that etiquette, by the way, Ellis, is that nobody eats the food that they put out for you.
No, the food is also maybe I just have some kind of a boy from out of town attitude. I always figured I was lucky to be there. I mean, you want me to go on at 9? You want me to stay till midnight? I'll stay till midnight. The notion, and I'm sure you feel like this, the notion that you and I could actually make a living.
Yeah, I know.
Having opinions and talk. I mean, I did this stuff growing up in New Orleans across a dinner table every night of the week for nothing. And the notion that I actually, as a kind of a quasi grown up, could do this for a living. I mean,
$8,000
Come on, it sure beats working, right?
Oh yeah, and I mean, you know, the amazing thing is that when I first started in the radio business, Ellis, the first thing I noticed was the, what I thought at the time was the extraordinary ego of the people that worked in the business. You know, it was all about, you know, how, and this is radio now. It's not like they got to wear makeup like on TV or something. But people were like, well, I want to make sure I'm properly placed. And I'm saying to myself, these are the most egotistical people as a group I have ever run across. But then when I was, when I first came into radio, I was naive enough to think that individual DJs were able to program their own music, which, of course, even back then they could.
But you know the difference? I mean, you were always one of the people that I think got along with everybody pretty much. I mean, you were always pretty pleasant and nice to the young guys. And I think the difference is that most of those jerks are gone because they alienated enough. And, you know, here you are after a bunch of decades doing this stuff pretty, you know, at the top of your game with a big venue and a big national audience now. I mean, the part of the reason for that, I mean, obviously
I'm
you got...
I'm scared to death. You scared me now.
No, Riley. I mean, you got the chops, but I'm saying part of it is it is a personal thing. I mean, you know a lot of people. You've established relationships. I mean, listen, I have so few other skills in life. Dude, if this writing and talking thing doesn't work, I mean, I'm selling shoes. There is no plan B here. I've got to suck up to anybody I run across.
You know what? My plan B is parenting. You know, I'm going to be a stay-at-home dad if this gig doesn't work out. Look, I mean, you know, we're at a point, I think, both of us in our lives, where we've seen a lot, we've experienced a lot, certainly in this business, and we see the news through the prism of our past experience. We've seen politicians pander before. We've seen politicians act like fools. And during the next 2 hours and 45 minutes, we're going to expose the pandering and the foolishness of an awful lot of politicians.
Oh, well, I mean, this Schiavo case, the Terry Schiavo case, has obviously brought out the kind of the most base versions of that, right? Because you've got politicians who are playing to a very particular and a very revved up base, that rigid wing of the religious right.
Yeah.
And, you know, they see great opportunities to pander, to grovel, and it's hard to know how much it's working. I mean, I think it's playing to the choir, but I wonder how broader groups of Americans are reacting. We've got some polls on that are actually kind of interesting to take a look at.
They're fascinating. We're going to get the latest on the Schiavo case because there's stuff that happened yesterday and stuff that's coming up later today. We're going to take a quick break. It's 13 minutes past the hour. This is Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Rob Corddry from The Daily Show, here to remind you that when top news reporters and investigative journalists like me want their news skewed so far to the left it's wearing a dress, we turn to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. He'll be back on Monday. Our special guest co-host this morning, columnist Ellis Hennekin from Newsday. And by the way, you wear a lot of different hats. We're going to get into some of the other hats that you wear as we go through the broadcast this morning. But Terry Schiavo, is there any? I mean, I hate to say this because it's going to make me sound like a hard-bitten cynic. But is there any end to this?
Well, I mean, there's an end in the particulars that the woman is probably not going to last a whole lot longer. But will the issues go on? Absolutely. You lit a fuse here that's going to play out in the right-to-life world in the presidential election next time. But it will be very, I mean, it seems like death is pretty near, right?
This is what we're hearing. Now, there was a whirlwind of court activity that took place yesterday. First, the Federal Appeals Court, very early yesterday morning, ruled the 11th Circuit, ruled in a 2-1 decision to allow the feeding tube to remain out.
Right, and that was a crucial step, right, because that was the first thing confirming what the trial court, the U.S. District Judge, had done, saying that, you know, the federal courts are not necessarily going to elbow their way into this thing just because Congress gave them the green light to do so.
Absolutely. Then the family, later yesterday, went to and asked that the entire court, the entire 11th Circuit, all 12 justices hear the case. They did. They ruled 10-2 yesterday afternoon affirming the smaller group ruling. In other words, the ruling that says the tube stays out.
That's right. The en banc, they call that, the entire court ruling.
Yeah,
absolutely. But you know, you can see as the day went on, Mark, that it looked, the hope was draining out of the Schiavo parents, right? They were starting to say, well, you know, we thought we had this big victory in Congress, but you know what? It turns out that it didn't really deliver them very much, at least so far.
Now, late last night, they did go and ask Justice Anthony Kennedy, who has jurisdiction over the 11th Circuit, to get the full U.S. Supreme Court to rule on this issue for the third time, it would be now.
Yeah, and you can't be too hopeful from their perspective because, you know, the court a couple times before has already declined to get involved. So I'd be really surprised if the Supreme Court inserts itself in this case.
Now, what I think may have surprised the Schiavo parents as well is that the Congress, at least some members of it, seem to be peeling off of this thing. It seems as though the president is bailing out on this thing. And one of the other things they did yesterday was try to get the Florida legislature re-involved. They introduced a bill in the Florida State Senate that said essentially that the tube would have to stay in because Terry Schiavo had no living will or no written document saying that the tube should be taken out.
Yeah, but they're grasping at straws, right?
They're
looking anywhere. I mean, my God, if they could think of anything new. In fact, folks, if you know something, probably to keep it to yourself for the time being.
Absolutely.
But don't give any new creative ideas. But you're right. It's looking increasingly like the president seems to be easing out. The Florida legislature doesn't want to jump back in. Supreme Court has not yet done anything. It doesn't look like they're going to. Jeb Bush might be the president's brother, of course, governor of Florida, might really be their last hope. And indeed, in the past few hours overnight, he's actually talking about some kind of extreme, I guess you could call them creative responses.
You could call them creative. Some people, some cynics, might call them quasi-legal. Because one of the things that happened yesterday was that when the original state judge, Judge Greer, decided to rehear this case, and of course, that issue is going to be decided at noon today. One of the things he granted was Michael Schiavo's request that Florida authorities not be allowed to move Terry out of the hospice where she is currently being kept.
Right. George Felos, his lawyer, said that he was getting reports, credible reports, he called them, that the governor might actually send in state employees and doctors to grab her or force a tube upon her. Judge Greer was saying, we're going to put some sheriffs surrounding her to try and make sure that kind of thing doesn't happen. But it's going to be a very dramatic day ahead out in front of that hospice in Clearwater.
Well, yeah, I believe there were a number of people who were arrested yesterday, including some people who, as a symbolic gesture, were trying to bring water into the hospice for Terry Schiavo. You know, talk about an exercise in frustration.
Yeah, it's a nice dramatic symbol, though, isn't it? I mean, it's something that the left would dream up when we were smart.
Coming
with a cup of water, saying, please, please.
Yeah, and it makes, you know, it makes for great video.
Good TV pictures.
Yeah, great TV pictures. And, you know, that is going to be part and parcel of what we see over the next little while is a media circus around this woman, assuming that the courts continue in the current vein, around the woman dying.
No, you're absolutely right. And there's so many levels of it, right? There's the legal fight, there's the medical debate, and what you're pointing to now really is the theater of it.
Yes.
Which is, in some ways, maybe even more important than the other stuff, right? That guy, Randall Terry there, that right-to-life Operation Rescue guy, who really is the director of this little morality play that, whether we like it or not, we're frankly all part of.
Yeah, and you know, Ellis, one of the things that really scares me about this, and I'm not trying to be an alarmist, I have no independent anecdotal information or otherwise.
Oh, go ahead, alarmist.
But it scares me when I start hearing some protesters around the Schiavo case talking about the tyranny of the judiciary. You know, not for nothing, we've had people connected with the judiciary shot recently in courtrooms, the out in Chicago, the husband and the mother of a judge. It just makes me very nervous that you know, people start talking about tyranny in connection with the court system. And, you know, some people on the fringes, I'm not talking about necessarily even the people that are uttering the phrases, but the people on the fringes may get the wrong message from some of this.
Well, Mark, you know what people mean when they say tyranny of the judiciary.
Mm.
They mean the court ruled against me.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we love judges when they're on our side, but when they start ruling against us, we start denouncing activist judges and talking about tyranny of the judiciary.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that, and you know, there's a story this morning that points this out. I'm not sure how many people knew that Congress had a hearing planned for tomorrow, for Good Friday, that they were going to do at Terri Schiavo's hospice.
Oh, this is the one where she was being subpoenaed to, you can't say testify, I'm not sure, to appear,
no.
I guess would be a better word. Right?
Yeah, and they were going to have, and you know, the symbolism of doing this on Good Friday would be to turn Terri Schiavo into Joan of Arc or something.
Yeah, I think maybe Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Remember, something bad happened to him on Good Friday, as I recall.
Yeah. But that particular bit of theater appears to be, at least if published reports are to be believed, off the table for now.
Yeah, no one seems to be pursuing. I mean, that was really the congressional, one of the so-called creative responses out of the Republican side in Congress. It seems pretty much to be a base. See, I think it's interesting to watch, Mark. I think that the people like President Bush at this point, and maybe even some leaders in the Congress, probably not Tom DeLay, but some are starting to say, hey, maybe we've gone a little too far. This thing does risk boomeranging on us and making us look a little extreme and a little wacky. So you might see that pulled in just a little bit.
Well, you know, I think, Ellis, that maybe they were looking at some polling that's been coming out that we've had access to say an overwhelming majority of the American people oppose the stand that Congress has taken. And that stand, by the way, has pitted Democrat against Democrat. More importantly, Republican against Republican.
Yeah, because you know what? So many people can look into their own lives. Let's do those poll numbers when we get back after the break. But so many people can look into their own lives and imagine such a thing happening in their own family. Let me tell you, whatever you decide, I don't think you want Bill Frist and Tom DeLay stomping around in your family.
In your family. And, you know, you wrote a column about that. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about this rift within the Republican Party around the Terri Schiavo case. We've also got a Palm Pilot coming up. We'll tell you which one, because I'm not sure at this point. Ellis Hennigan is our special guest co-host. Mark Maron is back on Monday. Because, all of the Maron fans, you know, they start blogging. And where is he? Where is he? He hasn't been around lately. What's going on?
I'm
going
to start doing my Maron invitations. It's a three-hour journey rolls along, Riley.
You're good. You're good. The Palm Pilot, Republican Rips, and so much more when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
34 minutes past the hour. Ellis. Chris plays that song just for me.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
Yeah, I know. Boy, talk about a voice that sounds satisfied. That's the guy. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Our special guest co-host this morning is none other than Ellis Hennigan. And, of course, Mark Maron will be back on Monday. It is time for a little segment we like to call the Palm Pilot. And here to deliver it, in the absence of both Maron and apparently Ramon, is none other than Kent, the Colonel Jones.
Good morning. It feels good to be a gangster.
Thank you.
Today, Bush appointee Paul Wolfowitz is in the middle of a charm offensive to convince financial bigwigs that he would make a great head of the World Bank. So today we have his Palm Pilot. 6 a.m., wake up. Once again, coast along on my good luck. 8 a.m., call Bono. Assure him that as World Bank president, I will be very sensitive to the struggles of emerging nations. And that I love U2's ironic period. The Pop Mart tour was completely underappreciated. 10 a.m., practice threatening deadbeat third world nations. Quote, what do you think this is, a charity? You're into the Wolfman 3 billion large. What have I done to deserve such disrespect? 1 p.m., respond to criticism that the Bush administration is trying to use the World Bank as an instrument of U.S. foreign policy by saying, yes, but it's a lead instrument. We're talking Jimmy Page here. 3 p.m., interview European officials for number 2 post at the World Bank. Sample question, true or false? Can a country be considered developing if it doesn't have oil? 4 p.m., press conference. Tell reporters, I'm deeply committed to the bank's mission of eradicating poverty. Do you realize there are oil men in Houston still driving last year's Cadillac Escalade? It's an outrage. 7 p.m., call President Bush. Tell him the invasion is going as planned. But like in Iraq, if anything goes wrong, I have no exit strategy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Colonel.
See you later.
All right.
Wolfman Paul, I guess they're calling him, huh?
Yeah.
All right.
Another charm offensive out of a guy who I never thought had any. It's amazing.
No, charm is not his long suit. Persistence is, sadly.
You know, that seems to be a common thread with many on the religious right. But this whole Terry Schiavo case, Ellis, has opened up some of the fissures between the religious right and I guess the procedural right.
I got to tell you, to me, that's the best part of the story. I mean,
yeah,
there's
me
nothing I like than to watch my opponents splinter. You're absolutely right. There's one strain of American conservatism that's, you're right, the religious-based social conservatives,
yes.
I guess we call them. And then the more libertarian, government, get out of my business kind of conservatives, and it's a really tough issue for that group, right? How can they be in favor of Congress inserting itself into the most excruciating decision any family can possibly make? And they're, I think, beginning to really raise some actual disagreement about this.
Yeah, they are. But, you know, the disagreement has to be tempered with apparently their deathly fear of Tom DeLay, the House Majority Leader, and a guy who jumped on the Terry Schiavo bandwagon like it was going 3 miles an hour on his front lawn.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. If you get to trace this thing, the story really is Tom DeLay and him recognizing early in the game that, man, this is one good way to pander to those religious conservatives who were so important in the last election.
Yeah, now you did a column last Sunday in Newsday here in New York about Tom DeLay and his role in the Schiavo case. And you did a really good job, I thought, of taking him to task on this. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, I got to say, it panned out nice. It's nice to be a little bit ahead of the curve on these things than to come in 8 days later. Yeah, it was, I mean, to me, he's such a fascinating guy, right? This small-town Texas exterminator known around Washington as the Hammer because of his aggressive way of forcing people to do things and to impose his will upon the legislative process. But to me, he was the perfect example, Mark, of somebody that if in my own family I had to deal with something like this, and in fact, to some extent I have, and I think most people have had the issues surrounding people getting older and people
yes.
getting toward death. I mean, welcome to real life. It ain't fun, but there you have it.
There you have it.
But could you imagine, you know, if you have a relative who is needing to face those issues, and here you are as a family, you're talking about it, you're seeking advice, you're praying about it, if that's part of what you do, and then have somebody like Tom DeLay muscle up to the kitchen table and tell you everything you did was wrong, and he's going to send in his troops and make it his own way. To me, that is just a... That's a very frightening position to be in.
It is. It's a frightening position to be in. And some members of Congress think that it's a frightening position for the Republican Party to take. People like Senator John Warner of Virginia, who was the only Republican, by the way, who opposed the Schiavo bill during the course of that voice vote. And John Warner says the following, quote, "This senator has learned from many years you've got to separate your own emotions from the duty to support the Constitution of this country. These are fundamental principles of federalism."
Yeah, now, I love hearing that. Did you see what Chris Shays in the House was saying? I mean, his
yeah,
quote.
Another Republican.
Connecticut Republican Chris Shays, quote, "The Republican Party of Lincoln has become a party of theocracy." Right, a party of religion and politics all mixed up together. He says, "My party is demonstrating that they are for states' rights unless they don't like what the states are doing." Christopher Shays, Republican of Connecticut. You go, Chris.
Well, you know what I think Chris Shays is scared of, Ellis, is the idea that if you go back to the early 1970s, to the dawn of, God help me, my radio career, and you look at each time the Republicans have gotten critical mass in Washington, starting with the 1972 landslide reelection of Richard Nixon, you have found time and time and time again that Republicans overreach.
Yeah.
It, with Nixon, it was Watergate.
Yeah.
With Reagan, it was Iran-Contra. With Bush, Bush the father, it was essentially the economy. With Gingrich, you know, during the Clinton years, when the Republicans took over Congress, it was the contract with
America. Sure.
And what you keep seeing is the Republicans trying to take what they consider to be a mandate one step further than the American public is comfortable with.
Yeah, man, I hope you're right about that. I was honestly figuring that the war in Iraq was the obvious reason for that. I mean, right, that it just took that idea one step too far.
Yeah.
And, you know, which is why I think so many people who opposed the Bush re-election were so frustrated by the result and the war's failure to really have that impact politically.
Yeah.
But you're right. It'd be interesting to see whether Terry Schiavo is that case. Boy, if you look at those polls we were talking about.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people, even people, what was so fascinating, the CBS poll was out in the last 24 hours or so, saying that even conservatives and evangelicals, two-thirds of people who identify themselves as conservatives and evangelicals, opposed Congress inserting itself into the Schiavo case. Across America, it was four-fifths of Americans said they thought it was a bad idea. But even in that core group, two-thirds against it, I think there might be an opening for Democrats and others on the left to say, hey, this is taking things one step too far.
Too far, yeah. Now, you know, when you start looking at that polling, and then you start seeing and hearing some of the things that Tom DeLay has said publicly about this issue, you wonder what universe he actually lives in. Last Friday, he was speaking in a Washington hotel in front of the Family Research Council, headed by Tony Perkins,
mm-hmm.
a guy who said with a straight face that his constituents were more concerned with same-sex marriage than they were with economic issues. Mm-hmm. I was absolutely flabbergasted by that, but it turns out to have apparently been absolutely true.
Yeah, but this is a conversation, right, that DeLay was having with a group of people that he felt were his friends and supporters.
Fellow travelers.
He didn't know, though, right, that somebody might be, what,
recording
that conversation?
Yeah.
Hey, he didn't remember Nixon, I guess, right?
I guess he didn't. But you know what? Tom DeLay is our special guest this morning because thanks to the people from Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, we've got Tom DeLay on tape.
Wait a second. This is Barry Lynn, right?
Barry Lynn.
The guy who always fights these religious encroachments into civil. What, no, wait, did Lynn show up with the recorder in his inside coat pocket or something?
I'm sorry, I can't answer that. Might incriminate me. I don't know. I don't know how they got the tape. I don't know who it was. It might have been Barry Lynn. But, you know, Barry, I'm beginning to think that conservatives know him by sight or something. So maybe they smuggled somebody else in. But this is a lot deeper, ladies and gentlemen, than the couple of sound bites you've heard Tom DeLay say. We're going to play you a sound bite now that kind of puts Tom DeLay's insertion into the Terry Schiavo case in a sort of different construct. Let's hear from the House Majority Leader.
This is critical. Important. I know you know that. It is more than just Terry Schiavo. This is a critical issue for people in this position, and it is also a critical issue to fight the fight for life, whether it be euthanasia or abortion.
Now you see. Now we're going to react to that. Because I think there are a lot of layers to what
I got like eight of them for you, Riley.
Yeah, right. But first, we got to take a break. It's 44 minutes past the hour. Ellis Hennick and Mark Riley, Morning Sedition, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Our special guest co-host is Ellis Hennick. Mark Maron will be back on Monday. And we've been talking a little Tom DeLay, Ellis.
Tom DeLay, Terry Schiavo. You know what I liked about that bite? Was that it pushed forward this story, recognizing that this really isn't just about one brain-damaged woman lying in a hospice in Clearwater, Florida. This really is the opening shot, Mark, in a what is going to be, I think, a very hard-fought battle about all of these issues, abortion, stem cell research,
yes,
right to die, euthanasia, all these issues that wrap up really, to me, in a neat package summed up by us controlling our own lives. And
yeah.
Boy, Shiloh's the first part of it. And DeLay, I think, pretty much admits it to the Family Research Council.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the next step in this, of course, is going to be their assault on the judiciary. Bush has already shot some salvos about wanting to split up the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco because they're too liberal. I'm sure they're going to try and do something about appointments to the 11th Circuit after these kinds of rulings. And what you see, I think, is a kind of crescendo that's going to lead up to the next appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court, Ellis.
No, you're absolutely right. You're already hearing the activists down in Florida talking about unelected judges. And what was the phrase used earlier? Tyranny of the judiciary?
Yes, tyranny of the judiciary. There are tyrants. There was a woman who was protesting in front of the hospice down in Florida where Terry Schiavo was being kept, and the woman said, each judge, and I'm paraphrasing, each judge who has ruled in this case is a tyrant, and we have to deal with the tyranny.
The damn black-robed tyrants.
Yeah, there they go.
Well, there's like 27 of them so far. You can't claim that it's just one nutty activist liberal judge, right? I mean, it's now gone through, what is it, 7 courts and 20-something different judges, and we're now on, what, our third visit to the United States Supreme Court? That great bastion of liberalism, the United States Supreme Court?
Headed by that flaming liberal, former SDS member, William Rehnquist? Is that who we're talking about here? I mean, it's absolutely insane. Yeah. But the DeLay, being a strategist, this guy didn't ascend to the top of the House just for laughs or just by being completely stupid. He is an avaricious human being. People hate his guts, but he knows how to play politics, and if you're going to beat him, you better know how he plays, and you better know how you play.
Absolutely. We have some more DeLay sound, don't we?
We have some more DeLay sounds where he continues the theme of the war against the right. This is how he speaks to the Family Research Council last Friday at a breakfast in Washington, D.C.
This is exactly the issue that's going on in America, that of attacks against the conservative movement, against me and against many others. The point is the other side has figured out how to win and defeat the conservative movement. And that is to go after people personally, charge them with frivolous charges, link that up with all these do-gooder organizations funded by George Soros, and then get the national media on their side. That whole syndicate that they have going on right now is for one purpose and one purpose only, and that's to destroy the conservative movement.
The whole syndicate. It's like an organized crime thing or something.
Well,
right?
I don't think, Ellis, that he used that word out of the clear blue sky. I think that he used the word syndicate very deliberately to tie his enemies to organized crime in front of this group. And I guarantee you that everyone who was at that breakfast, the true believers, went out and called put it in the same context. Yeah, there's a syndicate that's out to get Tom DeLay.
Yeah, no, you're right. The notion, let me just say this, if only we were half as successful on the left as he makes us out to be.
Yeah,
And how are your George Soros checks coming? I don't know. Mine is still sadly lost in the mist. You know, I'm still racing through my mind, Mark, about how this tape actually got out of that room. It may well be, actually, that some conservative with a conscience, one of those people like Chris Shays or like John Warner, who actually was in the meeting, in that closed-door session with Tom DeLay, was upset about some of this stuff and said, you know what, this really is going off the nut deep fringe. Maybe they were the ones who leaked out the tape.
You know, Ellis, that's the thing. If we go back over our common experience in this business, we've seen guys like Tom DeLay before, but, you know, you go back a few years and people say, what, him? What, are you nuts?
Yeah.
What is it? What? He's a fringe guy. He's crazy. He's talking all this, the conservative movement. And it's interesting that he calls it a movement, because the one thing that people most associate most quickly with movements is the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
So what he's doing, I believe, is subtly adopting the mantle of the civil rights movement by calling what he's doing a conservative movement and making him the embodiment of that movement.
Interesting. The Martin Luther King of American conservatism.
Yeah.
And you know what, too? Actually, I'll take you another step on that, linking it up with the churches in the same way.
Yes.
Because the civil rights movement, as you know, so church-based.
Yes.
And, boy, this one is this one is too.
Yeah. And, you look at the fact that even among some Democrats, there were people that had problems with the whole Schiavo issue from a conscience standpoint, not from a political pandering standpoint, not from we got to do this because it's, God sent us Terry Schiavo and it's going to help our movement. That's not how some people are seeing this.
But here's my question. Okay, if the polls are like we think they are, two-thirds to three-quarters of Americans, 80% in the CBS poll,
yes,
saying that we didn't want Congress to do this, if plenty of conservatives are split on it, why on earth did this thing sail through Congress so effectively? Where was the opposition? I mean, we heard Barney Frank say something.
Yeah.
We heard Waxman from out in California say something. But there were not too many voices against this a week ago in Congress, were there?
No. And later this morning, by the way, we are going to be talking with Congressman Barney Frank, who probably had the most cogent response to this entire mess on the floor of the Congress. We're going to be talking with him. He, of course, is a congressman from Massachusetts. And, of course, you know, he gets tagged as a kind of double liberal guy because he's gay. And he's a, you know, he comes from a liberal state of Massachusetts. He is the poster boy for everything that Tom DeLay hates. But the bottom line here is that he...
Wait.
What?
Barney Frank is gay?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I let the cat out of the bag? I'm so sorry. I am so terribly sorry.
Out in radio on Air America.
Hey.
Actually, though, I think he's actually spoken about it before.
Yeah, I think he has talked about it once or twice. Unlike
you
some...
rattled me there, Mark.
No,
I'm sorry.
Not to worry, but you know what? There's some unnamed Republicans that are still in the cloud. Anyway, we won't even get
Excuse
into
me.
That. We
I'm
don't
sorry.
Want to cast this.
I apologize.
And
I'm
by
sorry.
The way, you know, there's nothing wrong with being gay, folks. That there is really... I know that some of our listeners are going to disagree. You know, Ellis, when I did a local show here before, I used to get calls from whenever I stood up for gay rights, people jumped in my chops. You know, hey, that guy's a Bible. Hey, I go to church. I still believe in gay rights. There's nothing to me incongruous in, you know, being a God-fearing man, such as I am, because I used to consider myself extremely lapsed. I don't know about you, but I used to think, you know, if I went to a church, I'd get struck by lightning.
Mm.
I'm gone, and I haven't been. So
good.
I'm starting to enjoy it. But Tom DeLay is running an extraordinary game here. We're going to get into that in our next hour, and we're going to invite you, our listeners, to give us a call as well and tell us, how should Democrats respond? Richard Cohen wrote a piece in the Washington Post, says Democrats, other than Barney Frank, have largely been silent on the Shiloh issue.
Yeah, I think it's been a mistake. The voices are starting to rise a little, but frankly, it doesn't take as much boldness to do it today as it would have 1 week ago when Barney Frank was standing on the floor of the House of Representatives and calling this what it was, which is theocratic demagoguery.
866-303-2270 is our phone number. We want to share, want you to share your thoughts with us. How should the Democrats react? How should the Democrats deal with the Shiloh issue? 866-303-2270. We'll be right back. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Weather.
Six minutes past the hour. Good morning. It's Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is out. He will be back on Monday. And our special guest co-host, acclaimed columnist, Mr. Ellis Hennigan.
Good to be with you, Riley. You know, that music, that kind of scares me a little bit. What's Chris up to? What's the stuff he's playing in here?
Chris has got all kinds of magical stuff that he can do in here.
I'm hoping he'll do that thing about the gangsta again.
Yeah, man, that was fun. But, you know, Chris never repeats himself, though. That's the thing about him. He's like Miles Davis. He goes from idea to idea to idea.
Well, actually, that song plays... three times a day.
Oh, the top of the hour, yes.
Who is that?
That's the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Oh, I was going to say, but doing like an Isaac Hayes imitation or something. The gangster thing.
Oh, no, the gangster thing.
Oh, no, that was actually taken from the movie Office Space.
Ah, there you go.
It's the Ghetto Boys.
The Ghetto Boys. Man, they had a long career. Are they still around, Chris?
I suppose so.
Hey, I don't know.
I'm playing their music.
There you go. They must be happy for you. Yeah. Ellis, how you doing this morning? We got a bank full of phone calls about this Shiloh delay, what should the Democrats do thing.
Yeah, no, we got to get to it. Let's do this, though. You want to just quickly bang out that tape? This is one bite from DeLay, right, that's been all over the media in the last 24 hours. That one about, what was it, Terry Schiavo being God's gift or something? Do you have that, Chris?
One thing that God has brought to us is Terry Schiavo to elevate the visibility of what's going on in America.
Wow. Talk about feeling good to be a gangster.
Sure nice to know people in a persistent vegetative state right there when you need them, huh?
Yeah. I mean, this guy... will literally stop at nothing to achieve his ends.
Yeah, but it goes a lot further than that. I mean, it's not just like, look what God gave us, here's something we can pander to. This really is a much deeper strategy. You want to hear more from DeLay?
Yeah.
It's to destroy conservative leaders, and it's to, not just in elected office, but leading. I mean, Ed Kohlner today at the Heritage World Foundation was under attack in the National Journal. I mean, this is a huge nationwide concerted effort to destroy everything we believe in. And you need to look at this and what's going on and participate in fighting back. Don't, you know, the one way they stops churches from getting into politics is Lyndon Johnson, who passed a law that said you couldn't get in politics or you're going to lose your tax exempt status, because they were all opposed to him when he was running for president. That law we're trying to repeal. It's very difficult to do that. But the point is when they can knock out a leader, then no other leader will step forward for a while, because they don't want to go through the same thing. But if they go after and get a pastor, then other pastors shrink from what they should be doing. It forces Christians back into the church, and that's what's going on in America. The world is too bad, I'm going to go get inside this building and I'm not going to play in the world. That's not what Christ asked us to do. And so they understand that. It is a political maneuver, and they are going to try to destroy the conservative movement, and we have to fight back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of that is a little paranoid, right? I mean, I don't think the left is half as organized as he gives you credit for.
Well, you know, he seems to be saying that the conservative movement, people who go to church, are in danger of being wiped off the face of the American landscape. It's very, very scary stuff. It is extraordinary, an extraordinary level of pandering. And remember, all of this is going on, Ellis, against the backdrop of investigations of Tom DeLay that could lead up. Remember, two of his boys have already been indicted down in Texas about campaign finance violations and that sort of thing. And when he starts talking about the attack on the conservative movement, that they want to silence people like him, what they're talking about is, wait a minute, you know, that way he has inoculated himself against the possibility of indictment and the possibility of some of his base supporters questioning if he actually did what the indictment, if it comes or if they come, say he did.
That's just the syndicate ganging up on him, too, now. Huh?
Yeah, it's the syndicate.
You want to go to some calls?
Yeah, let's go to some calls.
It'd be interesting to hear what people think about. Is this just business as usual in American politics? Is there something more extreme, almost un-American, about this kind of stuff? And how should those of us on the left counteract this kind of argument? What's the best way for us to step forward and say, you know what, that isn't true, and here's why, and here's what we ought to do about it? I wonder what people think about that.
Yeah, I wonder, do people think that we should just sit back and let them self-destruct? Are they going to self-destruct? Let's find out. Let's talk first to Stephanie, who's calling us from the mic in Madison, Wisconsin. Stephanie, good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, Mark Riley. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Say good morning to Alice Hennigan.
Hey, hello, you're Ellis Hennigan.
Hi, Stephanie. Good of you to call. What do you think about this? What's the best way to answer DeLay? Is this just business as usual? How do you read it?
Okay. How I read it is this. I think the Democrats, and I told your screener that I would not be vulgar, should grow some nads, okay? They get some cojones. They need to stop acting like whimpering little puppies and saying how, you know, we're the minority power party. They would be so much more respected if they took some powerful stances and spoke up and showed some courage.
Yeah, and you know what, Stephanie? It doesn't even take that many nads if you believe these polls. 4/5 or 3/4 of Americans actually support Democrats in this. That's not the time to be silent. Go ahead and start pandering on your side, too.
Right. You know, and we have got, there's a whole lot of rationality and reason that we have on our side. I'm an independent, but I'm really, you know, almost like a kind of a Democrat. My politics are pretty much moderate to left. And I think what the Republican Party is doing is ghoulish. I mean, you know, and I think part of it is that they have had no boundaries set for them. They're like little, in some ways, they're like little out of control children who, you know,
kids in a candy store.
Yeah. The more they're allowed to do what they're doing, you know, the more they're going to do. And I'll tell you, Tom DeLay, it's too bad that guy can't be working for some for good causes and for
yeah.
because he's a very canny, very I mean, I think he knows he's handing a line.
Well, here's a hopeful thought for you, Stephanie, is that Bob Barr, one of the most scurrilous Republicans out there, is now fighting against the USA Patriot Act. So
yeah, that's
actually,
amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, good politicians, I mean, bad politicians can actually do good things once in a while. Good call, though. Huh?
Yeah, it was an excellent call. And remember, too, we are going to have a Democrat with cojones on with us later this morning when Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank joins us, because, again, he got up on the floor of Congress, on the floor of the House, and told it like it was, told it as he saw it.
Yeah. You want to go to Tino in Atlanta?
Yeah, sure.
Tino,
let's go. Hey, how you doing? Good morning.
Doing great, doing great.
Hi, Tino.
Thank you for making my my commute to work bearable.
Oh, thank you.
What I wanted to talk about, actually, I've got a guy I used to work with who is extremely right-wing, and then I'm on the other side, and whenever we talk politics, it's kind of like, you know, two brick walls crashing.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into him yesterday, though, and he came up and he said, basically, I've got some great news for you that you're going to love, Timo. And that is that I'm absolutely disgusted with my own party. And this goes with, you know, you guys are talking about these polls, because he felt not only were they, you know, just taking advantage of this personal tragedy of Terry, but also that, you know, this archaic thing that we used to call checks and balances wasn't there anymore.
Yeah. Great point. It does make it maddening, though, doesn't it, when the Democratic politicians are slow to raise their voices on this. I guess, Mark, we can try and spur them along a little
bit. I
think
we should be able to spur them along. And remember, too, that a lot of the people who have been talking about this, Bill Frist, all of these different folks, John Warner, a lot of these folks have their own ambitions further down the road. Bill Frist has talked about possibly running for president. Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, who has inserted himself early in the process. Also, somebody that's being touted to extend the Bush dynasty, such as it is.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be delicious if they think they're pandering and it's going to affect them and help them politically, that it ends up boomeranging and actually hurting them?
That would be wonderful. That would make my... I'd give a party.
Is that possible?
I really would. 15 minutes past the hour, we're going to come back. Those of you holding on, please stay with us. This is Morning Tradition. Mark Riley and Ellis Hennigan sitting in for Mark Maron.
I'm Reverend Al Sharpton, and I may not be part of his diocese, but I listen to MILF Cardinal Milfington's Rapture Watch on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Welcome aboard and good morning to all. Mark Maron will be back with us on Monday. He's on a much deserved vacation. Right now, our special guest co-host is none other than acclaimed columnist, Mr. Ellis Hennigan.
Good to be with you, Mark. You know, I love, by the way you do that. You get that voice on, this is Morning Sedition.
Yeah, I know. I don't know where that comes
from. Where
did
you learn to talk like that?
I don't know. My dad probably, he used to yell at me a lot. I'll tell one of my dad's stories later on when I tried to kick him once when I was like 6 years old and he beat me into insensibility. Anyway, we're talking about Terry Schiavo. We're talking about Tom DeLay. We're talking about how should the Democratic Party react and respond to obvious Republican and Christian right machinations on the Schiavo case. Do they need to stand up? Do they need some cojones, as one of our previous callers said?
Some, what you call them? No.
Nads. Some of our listeners, particularly our women listeners, get upset when particularly Maren talks about nads, because they say, you know, you don't have to have nads in order to act in a strong, assertive fashion. And they're right. It's just a colloquialism, maybe?
Oh.
Nads are both genders?
Is that true?
Women got nads?
Oh.
Gee, I must have flunked biology. Let's go back to our phones. Let us say good morning to Jack, who's calling us from 1010 in Phoenix. Hey, Jack.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
You hear you fine. How you doing?
Go ahead, Jack.
Oh, gosh, these guys are scary people. How do we know that we're almost right now, maybe in the middle of a second civil war? They're just waging it right now where they can, and we don't want to wait till they get the military on us. I'd rather fight them on the Senate floor and debate them. And, you know, haven't the judges been getting their life threatened over this?
Well, that judge, down in Florida, he's had to walk around with...
Judge Greer.
Greer.
The one who made the original rulings against the parents.
He's got sheriffs escorting him around the tough streets of Clearwater.
Yeah, now, you know, he's making another ruling at noon today. Today is... And of course, this is where really, Ellis, I believe, at least for me... And by the way, Jack, thank you very much for the phone call. This is where I think they crossed the line. They are now alleging... And this is how they've managed to get a rehearing in front of Judge Greer. They are alleging 30 separate acts of abuse by Michael Schiavo against his wife.
Yeah, some of that stuff is just outrageous. I mean, to turn this guy who for 15 years has stood by this woman who has tried to exercise her wishes, to turn him into some kind of a wife beater or abuser is just outrageous. Let's go back to the phones. Kathy in Columbus. Hey, Kathy.
Hey, Kathy.
First of all, I do have NAS.
Oh, go on, girl.
Go, you go.
I love your show, and it's the only thing that gives me sanity. I am a mother of a two-year-old. I'm an accountant, and I drive an hour each way to work every day. But I want to say that we need to stand up and we need to be active. We need to talk. I have bumper stickers all over my car. You know, we just really need to, you know, take a stance against this. My father was in a coma last year, and I had to make the decision of taking him off of life support.
Oh, my goodness.
It was the most horrible experience of my life. But I know in my heart he didn't have a living will, but I made the decision to let him go because of the quality of life. And I say that for myself as well. I'm so energetic and outgoing, and the last thing I would want to do is to lay in a bed and die that way.
Now, Kathy, in your own family, how did you guys deal with that? I mean, did you talk about it? Did you seek advice? How did you figure out how to deal with such a thing?
Well, actually, it was just my father and I. I'm an only child, and I worked with the hospice people who were my angels.
Mm.
And for anyone to say that they're murderers, they are the most wonderful people.
Yeah.
They keep the person in a very comfortable condition, and you know, and it's not like I was able to sponge my father's mouth with her and, you know, just keep him very comfortable and let him go peacefully. And but you know, they are wonderful. They are wonderful people, and thank God for people like that.
Well, he's lucky to have a daughter who would take that kind of care.
And
all I can say really is that thank goodness you didn't have some politician beating on the door or protesters screaming outside about the decisions, Kathy, that you were making for your dad in his most difficult hour. Boy, that would have made it 100 times worse, I'll bet.
Well, thank you very much, and I just wanted to say I'm feeling horrible right now because I'm, you know, people like me are being viewed as murderers, and we're not murderers. We're giving back life, except in a different state.
Well,
thank you so much. You're a hero
on this station.
Absolutely.
I think, right?
Thank you very much. Let's go next to Joe, who is on XM in Tampa, Florida. Joe, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you guys?
Good.
Hey, Joe.
What's on your mind? What do you think folks should do? What should Democrats do? What should progressives do?
Well, I think Barbara Boxer is who I think of. I don't know whether you would say she has NADS or not, but somebody's got to fight back. I took care of my mother. I was the only family member kind of involved when she was dying, and she had Alzheimer's. And I remember getting the call that the doctor said, well, she's ill and she's in pain, and I can continue to give her a morphine derivative to ease, you know, make it much less painful for her stomach illness. But it means she'll die in probably in a week or two, or I can, you know, let her suffer and she could live another year. And my mother at that point had no, she didn't even recognize me at that point, and she was in a hospice, but a long term care facility. And I didn't even have to think about it. I'm not religious anyway, but religious considerations notwithstanding. You know, a woman could live in nowhere in pain for a year, or she could die peacefully and without pain. And, you know, I gave her up 9 months earlier, whatever it might have been anyway. But it was about her, not about me. I was incidental.
Yeah.
Certainly somebody, a group of people, need to take lessons from Barbara Boxer. I'm from Connecticut. I'm in Florida now, but I live in Connecticut. And I am so... disillusioned with Joe Lieberman and this, his kowtowing on the bankruptcy bill and other stuff like that. As progressives and Democrats, if we don't get some some backbone or lead in our pencil or something like that, this is just going to get worse and worse.
Yeah, but it's those human experiences, Mark. It's a great call. Thank you very much for sharing that. That's what's going to move people on this issue is actual human experience.
And we're hearing a lot of that this morning, Els. Yeah. I'm kind of surprised, quite frankly, that so many people who have been through a similar situation, and I've been through a similar situation.
Yeah. Everybody.
Everybody has been through it. If you've ever lost a loved one, you have been through this situation, and we want to thank everyone who's called and who has shared that with us, because it's some very personal stuff, and that's what I think Tom DeLay and his ilk do not understand. It's personal.
It cuts across all political lines, too. Conservatives have family members they love, too.
Yeah, absolutely. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about this, and then we're going to talk about Social Security. They had one of those actuarial situations yesterday, Ellis, where they decided how long it's going to be before Social Security goes broke, and it appears that Medicare is the real problem, but we'll talk more about that when we come back here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Good morning, 34 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Ellis Hennigan, acclaimed columnist, is our guest in studio. Our guest co-host in studio.
Good to be with you, man. This is fun.
You know, I just had what Mark Maron describes as a brain skid there for a second.
Uh-oh.
But I'm back!
I'll fill for you. Don't worry.
Thank you very much. Mark will be back on Monday. And we're now going to talk a little bit about Social Security and entitlement programs. Because, you know, some people argue this is what the Congress really ought to be dealing
with. This is a perfect solution, by the way, to the problems of Social Security.
Tell me.
Don't get old.
Ooh, don't get old.
You won't have to pay private accounts, running out of money in the fund, 2042. You don't have to worry about any of that. If you just don't get old.
You know, one of the things I find fascinating about this whole Social Security discussion is, A, you know, they had the whole report about when the Social Security Trust Fund is going to run out of money. Yeah. In other words, when everyone gets all their benefits cut. That's what Bush makes it sound like is going to happen. But they've actually adjusted it by a year from 2042 to 2041. But what's fascinating about this, there's an editorial, Ellis, in today's New York Times that talks about the base figure that the trustees ran, which is the shortfall going from $10.4 trillion to $11 trillion this year. Now, you would think by looking at that that they're talking about $11 trillion gap this year. That's not what they're doing. They're not even talking about 75 years from now or 100 years from now. You know what they did?
Tell me.
They costed this out over infinity.
Yeah.
So what they're saying is this $11 trillion shortfall could end up happening over a 10,000-year period.
Yeah. Listen, all of these numbers, Mark, as you know, are political numbers.
Yes.
They're used, and on both sides, let's be honest, they're used to make a political point. When George Bush talks about when Social Security is going to begin to be in the red, what is that? Is that the 2012 date?
That's when he says, I believe, yeah.
But that's the date at which, not the date at which you start to run out of money, that we've been building up surplus all these years, and that's the date at which it begins to turn in the other direction. But it takes all the way to 2041 or 2042, depending on which number you believe. Some estimates, in fact, put it as far back as 2052. I know some of the congressional studies have said that, but you know it depends on exactly which projections you work and how your investments go, and exactly how many people are in the economy. So it's not a precise science. But don't forget, all of it is used as a political fulcrum to make a point. Bush wants to scare you, and others want to say, hey, you know, yes, it's something you got to deal with in the long run, but it ain't happening next Tuesday.
Well, I want to say a special good morning to two trustees of the Social Security system.
Oh, my goodness. You know these people?
Thomas R. Saving and John L. Palmer. Both of them had the guts to stand up and say what a lot of politicians and a lot of people that are talking about Social Security have refused to say until now. These two trustees say that Medicare's financial problems are far worse than Social Security's. Now, Thomas Saving is a Republican. John Palmer is a Democrat. So this is not an instance of Democrats piling on. This is a bipartisan, different position. Of course, Bush's Social Security trustees, there are three of them from his cabinet, Treasury Secretary John Snow, Health and Human Services Secretary Michael Levitt, and Labor Secretary Elaine Chao. Is she still there? I guess she is. Anyway, they didn't stray off the ranch. They say Social Security's problems have to be fixed. It's in crisis, blah, 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 blah. But these two guys, these are two independent trustees, one Democrat, one Republican, and they're saying, you know what, we've got to fix Medicare. And if you look at how Medicare is funded, if you look at the weight that Medicare places on some states across this country, particularly here in New York, Ellis, you realize that Medicare is a problem not just on the federal level, but right down to the state level.
Absolutely. I mean, it really is something that a lot of people depend upon, and it is in greater, far more urgent financial crisis. But, you know, I mean, the Bush administration has a great effort to remain disciplined and to remain on message, and the message right now is crisis Social Security.
Well, let's look at some numbers here. 2041, let's take the conservative number here.
Okay.
That's what the Social Security say, that's what the trustees say is when the time when the trust fund will begin to deplete itself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, when is the Medicaid Hospital Insurance Trust Fund going to be depleted?
Way earlier, right?
2020.
2020.
Yeah. Mm. Now, 2020, 2041. 2020, 2041. I was no math genius. As a matter of fact, I might have to get an adding machine to get all of those numbers out. But the bottom line is Medicare is in more trouble, but most people don't know it, Ellis, and most people are not going to put any pressure on their politicians to fix Medicare.
Yeah. Do you think the tide is beginning to turn on this, that the administration is starting to believe, you know, we may not get these private accounts that we were talking about, maybe this really isn't selling? I mean, the president's been out on this 60-city tour in 60 days, and the more he talks about it, the worse his poll numbers get on this issue.
You're absolutely right, but what he's doing, Ellis, is you have to give whoever is advising him credit for political canniness, if nothing else.
Hmm.
Bush does not have a hard and fast proposal out. He's got the accounts and the 4% and all of that.
Yeah.
But the actual details of how it's funded, what's going to get cut in order to fund it, we're talking about anywhere from $2 to $4 trillion it's going to take to actually implement all
the
this
transitional
stuff.
Costs.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
That's what they call them, transitional costs. And no one knows exactly how that revenue is going to be raised. Bush has very craftily stood back and said, well, we're open to all different kinds of ideas. So if the Democrats have an idea that, you know, we think has merit, come on in. We got a big tent over here.
Oh, that's a sucker's game, right? He's luring them out. You put your plan up, and it will take pot shots at your plan instead of you doing that at my plan.
Yeah, well, you know how it is with Social Security. These guys are going,
ooh.
Oops, I guess you're a loser. There goes your retirement. I mean, look, when you look at what he's trying to do with the black community, which is, by the way, and see, a lot of people are afraid to say this, the black community has been historically risk averse, all right? It has been our history not to take a great deal of risk with our money because when black people lived under segregation and that sort of thing, that was all we had.
Mm-hmm,
we could not take those kinds of entrepreneurial risks. They were not, those avenues were not open to us for a long time we've been here.
Yeah, but you notice one of the interesting, I think, canny Republican arguments in this is that blacks, they're able to make that argument that says, hey, blacks kind of get screwed in Social Security.
Yeah.
Because on average, they don't live as long, so they don't hang around long to collect as long typically as whites do.
Yeah.
How do you answer that argument? Because I'd like
real
to hear a good
simply,
answer to it.
You want to hear a good answer
please
to it? When blacks who do reach the age of 65 collect their benefits just about as long as whites do. The gap is in blacks reaching the age
that's
of 65. And that has to be dealt with, not in terms of trying to sell blacks on a sucker play, but finding out why blacks don't get to 65. But once black people do,
they live just as long.
They live as long and they collect benefits for, it's not quite as long, but they live almost as long and they collect benefits almost equal to, because there is a disparity in the extent to which blacks are able to take advantage of the system.
Yeah, interesting. I didn't know that. That's a good argument. Because I know that's something that's been thrown out there as this debate has rolled along, and something that, you know, makes Bush and Republicans saying, oh, hey, we're really being concerned here. We're really worrying about you guys.
Yeah. Now, I don't know. Yeah, right. Sure.
Finally. Yeah. Finally.
Well, you know, that whole 9% to 16% in Ohio really caught his attention, caught Karl Rove's attention, too. He got 9% of the black vote in 2000 in Ohio, 16%, 7% higher in 2004, and some people say that's what put him over the top in Ohio. Mm-hmm. So now they've set a target of getting 30% of the black vote nationwide for the Republican Party.
That ain't going to happen.
No, it's not. Well, you know what? They are trying to make it happen, and there's a lesson in there for Democrats. Democrats sometimes, and I think the Kerry campaign, if you want to fault them for anything, they wrote off a lot of red states where they didn't think they could win.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? The Republicans aren't writing anybody off. The Republicans are going to say, hey, we're going to come and sell our snake oil to everybody, whites, blacks, Latinos, you name it. And it paid off for them with the Latino vote, where they thought 35% was the minimum number they needed to win the presidency. And what happens? They got 44.
Yeah.
So bottom line, why not get bold? Yeah. Why not say to black people, hey, you can come under our tent, too?
Well, you were talking earlier, connecting that to Shiloh, I thought, in an interesting way.
Yeah.
Members of the black congressional caucus voting with the Republicans on the Shiloh, you would think of that as an issue that would pander to white evangelical Christians.
Yeah.
But maybe some of those lines get a little complicated. On gay marriage as well, you saw a lot of those members of the black caucus saying, well, this whole gay marriage thing makes us very, very nervous with our own church voters.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, a lot of that has to do with historic differences between the black and white communities about how they see homosexuality and about the public, what they perceive to be the public nature of homosexuality. That's what a lot of the black church rebels against. They say, hey, I have no problem with gay people, but I don't want to see two people holding hands walking down the street. That gives them a problem. And what the Republicans are trying to do is exploit that little bit of a gap, exploit that little fissure that they see within the black community and as evidenced and manifested by the black church.
I'm telling you, though, Mark, the answer in all of these cases is bring it back home to people's families. Everybody's got a gay uncle, a gay cousin, a gay kid, a gay brother. Same way, everybody's got an aging relative that we're going to have to deal with as time goes on.
Yep.
I can't believe on either side we really want Tom DeLay and Bill Frist stomping around in our lives in that way.
Oh,
I don't even think conservatives want that.
Well, they say they don't. They say they want government out of their living rooms, out of their bedrooms. But then the flip side of it is they often support causes, whether it be the whole thing about obscenity, indecency, etc. They support causes that put government right in people's living rooms.
Yeah, but we tell these stories in a human way. You just watch those numbers come our way. Let's be smart, man.
I believe that. I believe it wholeheartedly. And the person that will win the presidency in 2008, regardless of party, is going to be the person that transmits those stories and is able to rouse emotions in the American people best.
Yeah, we have Barney Frank in the next hour, right? He is very, very good at that. Steal lines from Barney Frank, I'm telling you. He is able to articulate those things in a way that average, normal folks, even people like me and you, can relate to him.
Barney in 08? What do you say? It's 45 minutes past the hour. Stay with us. We're right back. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition, the highest rated, most respected news show in America. On Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. That's 10 minutes before the next hour. Good morning. This is Morning Tradition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation, and he'll be back Monday. In studio, our special guest co-host, Mr. Ellis Hennigan. Ellis, good morning.
Good to be with you, Mark.
It's really good to be with you. And, you know, I don't feel so bad now because Ellis has got reading glasses. His are a lot more stylish than the ones I have, which I now have to wear. I wore these, you know, because I go for the Duane Reade specials. I don't even know which ones work.
Wait, I don't actually need these. It's more of a fashion statement.
Oh, that's a fashion statement.
Oh, completely a fashion statement. Yeah. I'm much too young for that.
Oh, okay, because, you know, I can't even see you now that my glasses are off over here. But, we were talking a little bit about Social Security, not to make the conversation totally over.
I want to be clear about one thing. I have not yet gotten that AARP card in the mail that I hear from some of my friends that they get.
Oh, no, I got one.
They just send it, whether you want it or not, right?
Yes,
they send it to you.
They send it to you. I don't know how they figure out who turns 50 when, but they send it.
But it's like when you're 24 or something, right? Well, 50, I guess that's it.
Yeah, it's when you, and it's almost like, happy birthday, here's your AARP card, now go get on an ice floe someplace and drift out into the ocean. I mean, it's a very weird scenario.
You can save $1.50 on a movie, but you'll feel like a geezer for the rest of your life.
That's right. You know, you can, and believe me, they got AARP discounts for everything, okay? Hotel rooms, flights, car rentals, the whole nine yards. I haven't really taken advantage of any of them, but I'm sure I will.
No, that part sounds okay.
Is that what I have to look forward to? A senior citizen discount, for God's sake?
I don't know, man. Ride the bus for cheap. It sounds pretty sweet.
It does sound sweet.
You have a future, Riley.
I don't know about Medicare, though. I mean, you know, Medicare is supposed to be there to take care of my health problems when I get
home. The doctor won't treat you, but you can get there on the bus really cheap. Don't worry.
Yeah, right? Now, wait a minute. You know, if Medicare runs out of money in 2020, you know how old I'll be in 2020? I'm really scared to tell our audience this. I'll be close to 70.
Mm.
I'll be the one needing the Medicare.
Mm.
And believe me, I think I try to take pretty good care of myself, but I still might need a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And here we got Medicare in such bad shape, it's going to run out of money 20 years before Social Security.
Yeah, so remind me again why it is we're all in a lather over Social Security and nobody's much talking about Medicare?
Because the president told me so. I remember that from Bible school when I was a kid. I mean, George W. Bush has made Social Security his signature issue.
Okay.
Why? Nobody seems to know outside of him, Karl Rove, and Ken Mellman. But they think, or they thought, that they had a winner with this. And Ellis, as you pointed out in the last segment, they haven't gotten very far.
Yeah, the polls aren't doing well. I mean, first of all, the older people are scared about it, even though they say, hey, you guys are protected. Don't worry. If you're over 55, it won't affect you. First of all, I don't think a lot of older people believe that.
No.
Secondly, a lot of the old people have younger people they care about. I mean, they don't want them to be squeezed in such a way.
Well, you know, that's the thing about Social Security that has become blurred during this Bush offensive on trying to reform or change or privatize the system, and that is that it was always set up so that people paid into the system to pay future generations' benefits. You're not putting it in so you're going to take it right back out again. It really doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Bush has framed this entire argument, it's like it's you are going to be the one. You 25-year-old. You 30-year-old. You 32-year-old. You're going to be the ones who are going to end up with no money coming out of this system.
Yeah.
And it's nonsense. It is utter nonsense. But you know what? We've had political careers and media careers where we've seen an awful lot of utter nonsense happen.
Well, that's true. I mean, you hang around this business any length of time, I mean, you certainly do notice these things kind of come back in circles, don't they?
Yeah, they kind of do. You know, you start thinking of, you know, is Bob McNamara all that different from Paul Wolfowitz? I don't know.
Maybe. He was a lot better than Paul Wolfowitz. He was actually a pretty smart. It's funny because, I mean, you and I have been running into each other on the street in New York covering stuff. I mean, you're in the radio business, me mostly as a newspaper columnist.
Sure.
And I do notice a certain rhythm to these kind of things. I mean, I feel like we've never had a Social Security fight in the same way we do now. But we had similar kind of issues that played out similar. And you do get to the point, I think, where you can predict how these things are going to come. Bush is going to get something here, probably, but it's not going to be remotely like the dramatic changes that he's talking about, I would predict.
Oh, no, he's not going to get the changes he wants, but I do predict that whatever changes he gets, even if they're, you know, minute in nature, he will declare victory and go home.
Well, that's smart policy. Same as we're doing in Iraq, right? Hey, that was great.
Hey, we won.
All right.
Yeah.
We're out of here, man.
Yeah, well, never mind we're constructing bases that will last into the 23rd century. We won. You know, and this is a hallmark of this administration, Ellis. And it has, to some extent, either cowed or completely confused the opposition so that, you know, and I will give them credit for saying we're going to draw the line on Social Security. But you hear, played a bit of Tom DeLay earlier where he made it sound as if the left, the progressives, the Democrats, however you want to describe us as a group, that we know how to win and we're going to win if they're not careful.
The syndicate we're talking about, maybe in the next hour we can play some more DeLay. What he said, those sound
bites. We can bring them back.
So, yeah, they're fascinating because here he is talking to the Family Research Council in Washington, the conservative, social conservative group, thinking he's among friends. but there was somebody in the room, maybe a conservative with a conscience, we don't know exactly who, but somehow Americans United for the Separation of Church and State got their hands on that tape of Tom DeLay talking to the faithful, and I believe he said some things that probably he wishes were not going to air on Air America Radio.
I know. We've had Tom DeLay virtually as our special guest this morning, but coming up in our next hour, we're going to be talking to a real special guest.
Who that?
Barney Frank. He's been on with us a number of times. We did a remote broadcast up in Boston a few months back. Congressman Frank joined us live at this coffee house outside of Boston, Somerville, Mass. It was a great experience. This is a guy who really just doesn't seem to care about the, you know, the political foolishness that a lot of folks seem to use as an excuse not to open their mouths. Barney Frank opened his.
Well, give him credit. He's standing on the floor of the House of Representatives when there were very few voices, Democrat or otherwise, saying, hey, this Shiloh thing is pandering, it is wrong, and we shouldn't be doing that. Barney, he was out front on that thing. Finally, others are coming around, but he was truly at the front of the line. We'll quiz him about that, ask him whether he got a lot of serious repercussions for doing it. I'll bet you not. I'll bet you it actually bounced in his favor in the long run.
Yeah, he probably will get, 92% of the vote in his district, as opposed to maybe 87?
Yeah, he's in a pretty safe district there. I don't think he's got to worry.
Oh, I don't think he's got a thing to worry about in the world. We're going to be talking to Congressman Frank in the next hour, and we're going to be talking some more about the issues of the day, including the Shiloh case, including some more Tom DeLay when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Good morning. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Mark Maron is on vacation. He returns next Monday. Our special guest co-host in studio is Mr. Ellis Hennigan, award-winning, famous newspaper columnist. That's right. Walter Winchell.
How are you, Riley?
How you doing,
How
man?
Are you? Good to be with you, man. You keep the pace going in here. I like this.
Well, we're trying to keep the pace going, trying to get folks up and out of their houses because, you know, it snowed here in the Northeast this morning. You know, but sometimes we get very provincial about weather here in the Northeast. We figure if it snows here, you know, it's the end of the world or whatever. They got, you know, snow drifts up to people's roofs out in the Midwest and some of the other places where we broadcast. And we don't always feel their pain the way we expect them to feel.
You know, it is so depressing. I was just down in New Orleans visiting my family for the weekend.
Yeah.
And the first couple of days. Came back. It flew back yesterday. When I left New Orleans, it was 70 and blue. When I got up here, it was already raining in that snowy, slushy. I was feeling very, very sorry for myself.
Now, you did a first when you were in New Orleans.
What
Tell us
mean?
About that.
A first?
You visited someplace. Didn't you?
A first?
A first? Yeah.
Oh, I know what you're driving at.
Yeah. I hope you do.
Walmart.
Oh.
I went to my... You're absolutely right. You know, it's funny. Living in India, people across America probably think this is really stupid, but I had never been to a Walmart before. We don't have Walmart in New York City.
No.
I mean, they have it, I guess, out in the suburbs. And
I think they have one in Jersey.
Maybe
and they have
so.
One
but it's not, but I mean, it is not really part of life of living in New York City.
Right.
And I was down in New Orleans, and I went with my brother to my first visit to Walmart. And
first?
It was, God, it was an eyeful.
Really? What was it like for you? What did you do?
First, can I give you a few impressions?
Sure,
first
please.
Of all, like, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but I think half of the shoppers were driving those little electric cart things.
That I have a nightmare about spending in the last 20 years of my life in.
No, these were, and I'm trying to be delicate because I don't mean to be bad about this, but not just really old people, but really big people. I mean, I don't know if there's a weight limit on these things or what, but I mean, there were a lot of very wide folks riding up and down the aisles in these. First of all, the place is huge.
Yeah.
And it has, I didn't realize, it has all these other stores inside it. There was a barber shop and an eyeglass. Well, I mean, it was like one of those chain haircutting places. Not an old-fashioned barber shop, but an eyeglasses place and a McDonald's and a. But I have to say, bright lights, 1,000 employees in these may I help you vests. The prices, you know, it's funny. I had heard, well, man, even if you hate it, the prices are really
good.
You know, the prices seemed I don't know. They seemed okay, but I didn't. It didn't make me think, oh my goodness, you know, I'm going to get a blow dryer for $1.99 or something, or a whole new 3-piece suit for $2.17. I mean, I thought the prices were okay, but
the prices are usually,
are they good? I don't know. Maybe I didn't know what to look for.
They encourage bulk buying. They encourage buying, you know, big stuff, because obviously Walmart's got a lot of room for big stuff. The bright lights, I kind of figure that's maybe just cut down on shoplifting or something. It makes it real easy for people to see on those little monitors that they have probably all over their stores.
Yeah.
One of my problems with Walmart, and I have only been once. I went to a Walmart
this
a couple of years
ago. This is pathetic,
ago.
By the way.
No,
two grown men. I mean, most people in America probably are saying, what are you talking about? Only been once?
Yeah. But, I mean, look, I am a big proponent of local commerce.
Well, that's go to the little stores in the block and on the front.
That's what I enjoy doing. So Walmart doesn't hold a great attraction for me. But, you know, you may have come up with a really great idea for Walmart. How about a Walmart Personal Mobility Vehicles Grand Prix? Where they have all these people in these big vehicles, and they just race around the store. And whoever wins gets a $500 gift certificate.
Yeah. We did just have a fascinating fight here out in Queens.
In Queens,
in
New York. That's
exactly,
right.
Where there was Walmart wanted to come into the city for the first time, and there was a big fight. It involved the unions here who were saying, hey, you can come, but we're going to organize here, and you're not going to be able to pay these minimum wage salaries to the people who are working in here.
Pay people a living wage, and don't lock the graveyard shift in the store overnight, which they were accused of having done several times in other stores across the country.
Why do they do that?
To keep them from, I guess, going out and doing whatever graveyard shift the employees do when they leave the store.
Oh, got to stop their restocking. But I do say, I found it fascinating. I thought it was an interesting study of America. Listen, you know, if I'm going to be a newspaper columnist and a TV talking head and a radio guy, I guess I ought to know
Walmart, right?
I'm getting down with the peeps. Come on.
Oh, man, I forgot about that. Yeah, the peeps do go. I mean, yeah, and the image that they project for themselves is amazing to me. You know, the old folks that work in the people that work in the stores with the outfits on, the older guys, retired people who come back into the workforce, and they're smiling, and they're there to help. And never mind, they're making $3 an hour, but, hey, we're here to help. And it's an amazing PR job that they do, and it's a very calculated PR job, and it is, in my judgment, Ellis, not all that different from the kind of PR that we see the Republican Party doing.
You know, it's smart, but we got to learn to play back in this game.
We've
got to learn to, you know, if what you and I love are the downtown merchants, the people who are in there, the mom and pop owning the store and providing services to the community, if we want to do that, we got to patronize it. We got to find a way to sell it. We got to figure out ways they can band together so they can get those volume discount wholesale prices and pass those savings on to the consumers. I mean, that really has to be part of the equation. Let's don't just throw up our hands and say, ooh, Walmart moved to town. We're dead. I don't like that defeatism.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is, and I hate to say this, people will rail and cry and scream about Walmart, and then one opens near them, they walk in, and suddenly they become these transformed zombies.
Well,
I got to get this. It's so much cheaper. And I understand, look, people, a dollar is a dollar, Ellis. Yeah. You know, if Walmart sells stuff cheaper than the place down the street, then you're taking an economic hit. And, you know, one of the things that they have been accused of doing across the country is putting extraordinary pressure, not just on the wages of the people that work for them, but on the wages of the people who work for the suppliers.
Yeah, well, listen, in the long run, it was the lesson we learned out of the auto industry almost 100 years ago. Unless the consumers can afford to buy the stuff, unless the workers are making a salary that they can actually patronize that store and other stores in the community, unless that whole economic engine revs up together, none of us are going to have anything.
None of us are going to have everything. It's called a living wage. And, you know, we've been led to believe in some instances where there have been cities across the country that have tried to pass living wage bills that the living wage is somehow going to bankrupt every employer in America. That's nonsense. It's a complete and utter nonsense. Pay people a decent wage, and what you'll get, A, is a more productive employee, an employee who can feed their family, who can pay their rent, pay their mortgage, or whatever. And I sometimes, Ellis, it's frustrating that we don't see enough progressive politicians, shall I say Democrats, standing up and dealing with some of these very crucial issues. And in fact, and this is going to get to what we're going to be dealing with for the next couple of segments, there are people who are calling into question whether or not the Democrats have stood up forcefully enough and been forceful enough in the Terri Schiavo case.
Yeah, I would certainly say they were not early enough. Finally, some voices being heard, but in those first couple of days, as this thing burst into a truly first-string national story, I heard Congressman Waxman from California, I heard Congressman Frank from Massachusetts, and...
That's about
and,
what you heard.
And that really was about what we heard.
Now, here's a quick quote before we go to break from Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. This is in today's Washington Post. Talking about Democratic politicians on the Hill, most of them seem to be cowering in some bunker, calling their consultants and pollsters, asking what they should do and how they should do it. Please have a memo on the desk by morning.
Yeah, but you know what? Read the polls, gentlemen. This might be a chance where your self-interest actually turns out to be right.
Right.
Four-fifths of Americans are saying Congress should not have gotten involved in the Schiavo case. Even two-thirds, Mark, of evangelicals and conservatives saying the Congress of the United States had no business elbowing its way into the life of that Florida family at that most excruciating moment. Turns out it was bad politics and it was bad morality.
We're going to hear the yin and the yang of the Terri Schiavo case. We're going to hear both from Tom DeLay and later on from Congressman Barney Frank when we come back here on Air America Radio.
This is Congressman Barney Frank, and you're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Is it Super Freak, or is it You Can't Touch This? Whoa, it's Rick! It's 20 past the hour. This is Morning Edition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley, our special guest co-host, Mr. Ellis Hennigan.
I didn't know you were going to dance, Mark.
Well, hey, you know, we got table space. There were times, see, I've seen a lot in this city over the years. I can remember days when people used to dance on top of bars in north of 110th Street here in New York. I won't get into it.
I always cast my eyes aside when that was going on.
So, you know, it's interesting. We were talking about the Democrats and about the ongoing Terri Schiavo case, which is ongoing in that Judge Greer from Florida, who was the original guy who ruled that the tube could be taken from, the feeding tube could be taken mm-hmm. from Terri Schiavo, is now going to be ruling again by noon today right. on what appears to be her parents' last hope, other than the Supreme Court.
Right. I mean, there's two or three things out there, right, that are still lingering. I mean, yes. I hate to use that term, but beyond Terry, whose own personal and physical fate is inching, frankly, toward death at this point. But we have Jeb Bush, who is threatening to do something. We don't know exactly what. Seemingly makes some effort to use his local Department of
Children's Services
to maybe try and take custody or something. The Supreme Court has not yet ruled formally on whether it's going to act on it. Justice Kennedy, of course, being responsible for the territory that includes the 11th Circuit down there in Atlanta, which is the federal circuit that's handling this case. So the Supreme Court is still out there with a question mark. Governor Bush is out there with a question mark. And Terry's own health is out there with a question mark. And then there's hearing at noon with Judge Greer. So there's still a few balls in the air, right?
Yeah, there are a few balls in the air. And one of the worst is the one that Judge Greer is ruling on, which alleges 30 different acts of abuse against Terri Schiavo on the part of her husband.
This is the slander of Michael Schiavo, right?
Yeah.
The man who for 15 years stood there and has been dealing with this thing and trying to exercise the wishes of his wife in this persistent vegetative state, and that he's being turned into the villain by the others out there.
One of our listeners yesterday said he's being turned into Scott Peterson, and I wouldn't really necessarily disagree with that. But, of course, looming over all of this, The 800-pound gorilla in the room is the House Majority Leader, Tom DeLay.
The exterminator, the hammer, pick your nickname, right?
The bug killer king. The man who decided to latch onto this issue and is planning on taking it for a touchdown. How far for a touchdown? Well, last Friday he was at the Family Research Council breakfast, and he told us how far he was willing to go with this. Those of you who've been with us all morning know that we've played this sound before. It's important because most media have not played this part of Tom DeLay's speech before the Family Research Council. And, of course, this came through the Americans United for Separation of Church and State. They're the ones who distributed this stuff. And it truly is, Ellis, in my judgment, some very scary stuff.
Yeah, because it's interesting. Most of the media have played that bite where, and it's a compelling bite as well, where DeLay talks about Terri Schiavo being a gift from God to the conservative movement in America. And that's shocking enough. But as you get into his conversation with those folks who he felt were his own posse, I guess we could call them.
Yeah.
He's revealing some strategic things that I'll bet he would rather not have be aired on Air America Radio. So you know what let's do? Let's play it.
Let's play it right now.
It's to destroy conservative leaders, and it's to destroy, not just in elected office, but leading. I mean, Ed Polner today at the Heritage Foundation was under attack in the National Journal. I mean, this is a huge nationwide concerted effort to destroy everything we believe in. And you need to look at this and what's going on and participate in fighting back. Don't, you know, the one way they stopped churches from getting into politics is Lyndon Johnson, who passed a law that said you couldn't get in politics or you're going to lose your tax exempt status because they were all opposed to him when he was running for president. That law we're trying to repeal. It's very difficult to do that. But the point is when they can knock out a leader, then no other leader will step forward for a while because they don't want to go through the same thing. But if they go after him and get a pastor, then other pastors shrink from what they should be doing. It forces Christians back into the church, and that's what's going on in America. The world is too bad, I'm going to go get inside this building, and I'm not going to play in the world. That's not what Christ asked us to do. And so they understand that. It is a political maneuver, and they are going to try to destroy the conservative movement. And we have to fight back.
A huge nationwide concerted effort to destroy everything we believe in, Tom DeLay warns. How could you do such a thing, Mark Riley?
It takes meds. It's what it takes. But you know what's really
interesting? I wish we were that organized, by the way.
I know. But you know what's interesting to me, Ellis, is that he infuses his own personal situation in this. Now, you heard, if you listen to that little bit of tape carefully, you heard him mention a guy named Ed Folner from the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah, who is he? I've heard the name, but I don't really know who he is.
Okay, Ed Folner is the head of the Heritage Foundation. And the reason why Tom DeLay mentioned him by name.
That's the conservative think tank,
the
Heritage
conservative
Foundation.
Think tank in, I think, based in suburban Washington, D.C., or based in that
area.
They're
in D.C., definitely.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting about this is he worked with DeLay to help boost the stature of the Korean lobbying group that is alleged, that DeLay is alleged to have taken a trip to Korea under their auspice, on the arm of this organization.
That's what we call it in New York. You know, let's do this. When Barney Frank comes to visit shortly, right?
Yes.
Let's play some of the DeLay stuff for Barney, and let's get his reaction to it, because I got to say, he really was the guy who stood up early in this fight and was not scared of Tom DeLay. I'd love to have him hear some of that and hear his reaction to that secret sound.
Yeah, he's going to be joining us shortly. And he can talk a little bit about Social Security and what the Democrats are doing there, too, and whether or not some of these allegations about Tom DeLay are sticking on Capitol Hill, because, again, he is saying to his fellow travelers at the Family Research Council, beware the people who come after me.
Interesting.
I'm
still wondering where how that tape got out of that room, boy. I like spies in the room,
yeah,
man.
Me too. Stay with us, Congressman Barney Frank joins us via telephone from Massachusetts when we get back here on Air America Radio. Save a super freak, she's super freaky.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Ellis Hennigan is our special guest co-host, and in about a minute or so, even less than that, we're going to be talking with Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank. He represents the 4th District in Massachusetts.
And one of the bold guys in the Schiavo case. You got to say, there were not a lot of brave Democrats out there as this thing unfolded just in the past week or so, but you got to say, Barney was speaking out very plainly on it when there were not too many who were.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing we didn't get to say about the Schiavo case is that one of the central figures in the latest court machinations, which, again, will end at noon today when Judge Greer down in Florida rules on this motion.
We hope it'll end. I mean, maybe. Who knows, right?
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, this petition was... drawn in part by a guy named Dr. William Cheshire. He's a board-certified neurologist at the Mayo Clinic. He's from Jacksonville, Florida. And he was the one that was saying, in essence, that Terry Schiavo was not in a persistent vegetative state. So that is central to their argument. And it turns out that he is actually involved with a Christian bioethics group. I didn't even know there was such a thing.
Yeah. He was someone who actually was in the room, or did he just do the diagnosis via videotape like Dr. Frist was doing?
Well,
right?
He actually did go in the room, but he was not allowed to examine her medically.
Okay, the people, the court-appointed doctors who've all examined her and had the real time and the real analysis, they're all unanimous, right, in their view?
Yes,
that
they are unanimous.
This is a persistent vegetative state. Yeah?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's a pleasure to welcome to our microphones a distinguished representative from the 4th District in Massachusetts, Congressman Barney Frank. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning, guys.
Hey, Congressman, how are you?
All right.
Thank you so much for being with us. Richard Cohen describes your conduct in Congress as a bravura performance in terms of speaking out on the Terry Schiavo issue. Why do you think that you were apparently all alone in this?
There are a couple of reasons. I think in the Senate, look, Congress is a very collegial place. And when you are fighting side by side with people, as the Democrats in the Senate have been, almost all of them with... Now that Zell Miller has gratefully departed, the Democrats in the Senate are all people who are trying to uphold, I think, the kind of values of progressivism. But they do it in different settings. Some have more difficult political settings than others. And there's this sense in a legislative body that people from relatively secure districts, such as mine, shouldn't provoke controversies that are going to entangle some of our colleagues from less secure districts. In other words, I think there were some senators who said, well, this isn't a problem for me. I'll make my position clear, but I'm not going to make Senator X or Senator Y vote on this tough issue. Now, along with that, I think, was the misperception that the bill to, in effect, have Congress veto the Florida courts would be a very popular one. I think the public has shown a great deal of censure. You know, there are millions of Americans, sadly, who've had to make the same decision that Michael Schiavo's made, namely to terminate life from someone you love who has been so terribly injured or suffered such a terrible illness that there's really no life left in the sense that the individual would have wanted to keep. And basically what Congress did was to say to those millions of people, well, you're insensitive. You're not good people. You know, we wouldn't trust you in this. And I think the public reaction has been much more, in my judgment, sensible. And people can make the distinction. It's one thing to think what you yourself would do in the case of Terry Schiavo. It's another to think that that's the kind of decision that ought to be made by 536 politicians, namely George Bush, the House, and the Senate.
Talking with Barney Frank here at Morning Sedition, Congressman, you look at the polls on this thing, and frankly, they're really pretty much with you on it. I mean, something like 4/5 of Americans, according to the CBS poll we have in front of us, say that Congress should not have intervened. Even if you look in that poll, the subset that is evangelicals and conservatives, 2/3 of them saying Congress should not have intervened. Why did Congress tilt so far in the other direction?
I think that some of my colleagues misread that. Look, there are some people who genuinely believe that life comes from God in their view, and that under no circumstances can you ever do anything to terminate life.
And God bless them. I mean, God bless them. If that's their view, so that's
the
fine.
Iraq. We do have to know there are certain exceptions.
And capital punishment. Don't forget that one either.
Well, capital punishment, frankly, I think is somewhat easier for them to defend. I mean, but the war in Iraq, an awful lot of innocent, totally innocent, totally healthy people get killed as a byproduct of a war that the president really acknowledges was a war of choice. But they believe God says this. But these people believe, by the way, that even if Terry Schiavo had left a living will, some of them would have wanted to disregard it. Look, in the state of Oregon, it goes beyond a living will. In the state of Oregon, they passed in a referendum twice legislation that allows assisted suicide. As long as you are yourself conscious and in full possession of your faculties, you can, under certain circumstances, as death approaches and you're in a terribly painful illness, you can have a doctor give you medicine to kill you. Now, there's no doubt about your will there. That's you saying it. You're still conscious. John Ashcroft has tried to arrest doctors, in effect, who follow that. So some of my colleagues are motivated by this view that under no circumstances, even if you want to do it, may you terminate your life. Others, as I said, I think felt politically. I did talk to a number of members of the House on the floor Sunday night as we were working on this bill. And, yeah, there were several who said, look, I don't like this bill, but I'm afraid of how it will be perceived. I think what happened here was Congress misread people. And I also think this showed the value of debate in a democratic society. One of the things we were able to do, those of us against this, was with the help of Steny Hoyer, who was the acting Democratic leader with Nancy Pelosi overseas. Ordinarily, this would have been debated under House rules for only 40 minutes, 20 minutes on each side. We got them to agree to a three-hour debate, and I think, frankly, that three-hour debate was a genuinely educational opportunity for the country, and I think as people listened to the arguments, we had some impact.
Now, Congressman, you've talked about the motives of some of your colleagues. I want to talk specifically about the motives of one of your colleagues, the House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. You were asked about this, and you didn't take a shot at the guy in terms of what his motives were for spearheading the drive to get this particular piece of legislation passed. But we want to play a little piece of sound for you of Tom DeLay speaking to the Family Research Council last Friday, and his putting this whole Schiavo discussion in a very different context. Let's go to that sound.
The point is the other side has figured out how to win and defeat the conservative movement. And that is to go after people personally, charge them with frivolous charges, link that up with all these do-gooder organizations funded by George Soros, and then get the national media on their side. That whole syndicate that they have going on right now is for one purpose and one purpose only, and that's to destroy the conservative movement.
Barney Frank, are you part of this syndicate with these George Soros checks? So what do you think about that kind of language?
Well, I would say, in general, about Tom DeLay, that his role in all of this gives true meaning to that old phrase, justice delayed is justice denied. Manifested. Mentioning George Soros, it's interesting. These are people who, it is extraordinary. I mean, being accused of character assassination by Tom DeLay is like being called silly by the Three Stooges. I mean, these are people for whom this is stock and trade. Let's take George Soros. Dennis Hastert, the speaker, who tries to stay above the battle, but has, of course, got his hand in all this, and in public on a TV show, accused George Soros of being a drug dealer. An outrageous, scandalous thing to say with no evidence whatsoever because Soros has stood up to them. So these are people, look, these are the heirs of Newt Gingrich who said we have to stop this view. And this all really began with Gingrich, the viciousness we now have. Gingrich said enough of this treating the Democrats as honest people with whom we disagree, enough of Tip O'Neill being a friend of Gerald Ford or even of Ronald Reagan. The Democrats are traitorous. They are vicious. They are corrupt. They are immoral. And the Republicans have carried that on.
But now, at the same time, we see some Republicans like Chris Shays, for instance, a wonderful quote from Shays saying that this Republican Party of Lincoln has become the party of theocracy. Do you see this issue leading to a split between the sort of the social conservative wing of the Republicans and that more libertarian wing of the party? I love that split. Bring it on, man.
I agree, but I have to say this. I have to say, while many of my friends are in the moderate to liberal Republican camp, at least in the people I work with, I am disappointed that, with the exception of Jim Jeffords, they really have not, it seemed to me, had the courage of their convictions. I give more credit for integrity in this case to some of the very conservative Democrats who became Republicans. There are moderate Republicans. I've said, by the way, that sadly, for a lot of the moderate Republicans, they have a three-step approach to most issues: ineffective protest, complete surrender, and denial. And you know, you see that on the budget, although they did vote against the Medicaid cuts. George Bush wouldn't have gotten those irresponsible, socially damaging, economically destabilizing tax cuts through if almost all the moderate Republicans hadn't been willing to support them, given the closeness of the Senate at that time after the first round of cuts. So for some reason, I wish they would follow through, but very few did. People said to me, well, wasn't it interesting that the Democrats were so split? Well, this is not automatically a partisan issue or and shouldn't be. What was even more striking to me was how the Republicans were virtually unanimous. I guess five Republicans out of nearly 200 who voted, or 180, only five voted with us. So I wish I was more optimistic about this. And here's the problem. The Republican activists, and I have to give them credit not for their ideas but for their energy, they dominate Republican primaries. If you deviate from the very conservative position, you're going to face a primary and you could lose. Senior moderate Republicans, Jim Colby from Arizona, who is pro-choice and as a gay man opposed the constitutional amendment on same-sex marriage and who has a reasonable view on immigration, he's a very distinguished member of Congress. He's been in Congress 20 years, and he had to fight very hard in a primary last time against a very conservative opponent, and he got something like 58 or 59%. It's just inconceivable for most of us that after 20 years of, you might have a tough fight in the final, but to have that kind of a fight in the primary is very unsettling, and it just goes to the strength of the right wing. So basically the answer is the right wing, through its mobilization in the Republican primaries, has essentially frightened the other Republicans into submission, and that's why I've become much more partisan, because even when the moderate Republicans say they mean well, in the end we can't count on them.
Our guest is Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts. We're going to take a quick break. It's 15 minutes before the hour. Congressman, when we come back, we want to talk a little bit about the flip side of this, because nine members of the Congressional Black Caucus and numbers of your colleagues from here in the New York area that are traditional progressives voted with the Republicans on that Schiavo bill. We want to talk about that, and we want to talk about Social Security as well when we come back here on Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Ten minutes before the hour, 50 minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Our special guest co-host is Mr. Ellis Hennigan, and on our telephones, Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank. Congressman, let me ask you real quickly, maybe to wrap and tie the Schiavo thing. I was surprised the Congressional Black Caucus, which usually votes as a block on most pieces of legislation, split on this issue. Nine members of the CBC voted with Republicans on the Schiavo issue, including Congressman Elijah Cummings from Baltimore, who is an ordained minister. But some people apparently felt that there were religious. Congressman Jose Serrano, one of the most progressive people in the House, next to you, also voted with the Republicans on this. How? Why so?
Well, as I said, this is not an issue that neatly falls along partisan lines. A lot of this had to do with your view of the separation of powers. Frankly, to me, the major problem there was the extent to which this ignored not states' rights, but what ought to be the distinction between the legislative branch and the judicial branch. And I think having the legislative branch decide things case by case is a terrible idea, and that's a core principle. But different people give different weight to these things. As I said, what was striking to me was not that there were divisions among others, because this is not the kind of typical liberal-conservative issue, but rather the question of how the Republicans were so unanimous. Now, for instance, Tom Harkin, who is one of the great liberals in Congress, works very closely with the disability groups. And while I disagree with the disability groups on this, I understand their position. They are afraid that there will be a temptation and a tendency to snuff out their lives for matters of convenience. By the way, one of the things that we ought to make clear is one of the pressures that they fear, disability groups, in this situation, either external pressures or pressures that an individual feels, are people worry when it's starting to cost too much money. And we need to talk about the absolute hypocrisy of the Republicans being so upset about what's happening to Terri Schiavo while trying hard to cut the Medicaid program, which helps support her.
Well,
is really the most extraordinary hypocrisy. The more you keep people like Terri Schiavo technically alive, then the more it's going to cost. And at the very least, you want to be trying to provide more money, not less. But as the ministers split, Emmanuel Cleaver, the former mayor of Kansas City, is a minister who spoke against this. John Lewis spoke against it. Other ministers went the other way. It is a tough issue for people.
Well, maybe we're talking about right to some life. Barney Frank, before you get out of here, I want to ask you about Social Security developments. Yesterday, the trustees saying, well, no, it's not 2042, it's 2041. People start to have real financial problems there. Am I right in sensing that a little bit of the air seems to be draining out of the private accounts? Where do you see this thing heading?
Oh, a lot of it's drained out, and I think two things. First of all, it's clearly unpopular, and unlike a lot of issues, the more the president talks about it, the more people get nervous. And by the way,
he should go on a 120-city tour instead of a 60-city tour.
For example, the stock market dropped 5% in the last month or so.
Wow.
That means if you had bought an annuity, on retirement a month ago, at a basket of stocks, a kind of index basket, and then you bought it today, you might be 5% worse off today than the guy who retired a month ago. I mean, the people understand the ups and downs of the stock market. And I think it's to me, an interesting indication that this notion that the American economy is in such wonderful shape and so fair that all you need to do is to let people buy into it. Obviously, the free enterprise system is the best way to create wealth. The difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is that the Republicans think that's all you need, and that you just let everyone buy into the free enterprise system, and you don't need any kind of government programs like Social Security to protect the minimum thing. And I think the American people say, no, that's not true. Yes, we like to see capitalism flourish, but we understand there will be ups and downs, there will be unfairnesses, there will be gaps, there will be people who won't make it, and we need to have a social safety net as well. And I think that's essentially what the country is now saying, no to this unrestrained capitalism as the way that we run our lives. Yes, to capitalism complemented by a reasonable set of public policies.
What do you think ought to be done in the short term to fix Social Security if you acknowledge there's a problem?
Well, there is a problem, but the short term, remember, the Social Security continues to take in more than it pays out until about 2018. The problem in 2018 is that George Bush and the others who took Social Security payments and put them in a tax cut are going to have to use that tax-cutted money to replace it. So the first thing you do is to undo many of the tax cuts of George Bush. That's the only reason there's any crisis between now and 2041, 42. Nobody knows for sure, but it's 35 or more years in the future. That is, if Social Security is credited with every penny that was paid in, there's no problem for another 35 years. We have time now between then and now, and here's how we fix it, I think. You basically make it more progressive. I do think we should do something about taxing incomes above $90,000. Not immediately above $90,000. I don't think people making $95,000, $100,000, if they've got kids to go to school, are where we ought to be going for the money. On the other hand, we could pick it up again and now cut up at $90,000. We could pick it up again at $150,000 and start taxing people who are making $150,000 and above and take some money. Secondly, there is how you index the initial Social Security payment. And the president has talked about a substantial reduction for everybody. Others have talked about, well, let's leave people who are making, say, $50,000 a year and less at retirement alone, but let's reduce it some for people who are above that. In other words, I think you can have a reduction in the amount of Social Security increases that go to people in the top, and you can increase the taxation on wealthy people.
Right.
And some combination of that. Because you don't have the problem until 2040, whatever.
Congressman, we're out of time, unfortunately. I understand your point, though, and it seems to make an awful lot of sense. We'll see how that plays out in the future. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
You take care. Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank, and now it's time to go to the Streisand compound, where Kent Jones has today's liberal agenda. Kent!
All right, get out a pencil. Write these down. One, urge members of Congress to intervene to prevent the death of federalism. Two, at the office, give a detailed analysis of the revolution in Kyrgyzstan. Then sit back and enjoy the blank stares of your coworkers. Three, picket outside the new Sandra Bullock film. Shouldn't it be Ms. Congeniality 2? Please. Four, fight high gasoline costs by bicycling to the Schiavo counter-protest. Five, today's phrase, just dropping into conversation. You want to know the real date Social Security goes broke? November 2nd, 2004, man. Wake up, sheeple. The rats are in charge of the cheese, man.
Ellis has been a real guest. Thanks so much for having me.
This was fun.
Yeah, we'll be back tomorrow to do it with cartoonist Ted Rawls. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.